I'm Alex. I'm an alcoholic. Glad to be at the AA meeting. Thank you all for having me. Thanks, Sam, for asking. And I appreciate it. I really like going to AA meetings. I'll have six this week. I missed Thursday. I took my son to see a concert, and we had a pretty good time there. He had his first concert confiscation. I was just standing back laughing. I stopped and got some bubbles for him. I went with another guy in the fellowship and his son, and I had these little, you know, the little bubbles from like the CVS, and they confiscated them. And Beck is my son's name. He was quite upset, and I just kind of stood back. I said, "You have no idea." Try a fifth of unopened Cuervo, you know. that's no fun. But that's the only. That doesn't happen every week. But I go to as many AA meetings as I possibly can, and rarely do I drop to four or below four. My sobriety date is April 21st, 1993. I have a sponsor. I've had the same sponsor since I was probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 months sober, something like that. My home group is the Buford Road Group. Liquor Store Sam, as we like to call him, will be coming down for our group anniversary on the 20th of next month. So if you want to get on the bus, the Madison Express, come down with him. We're going to have food at 6 and then the speaker at 7. Everybody's welcome. It's an open meeting. One thing I want to tell you that I want to talk about, and I'm not going to spend too long of a time talking about it, but I am going to talk about my drinking. I'm not one of those guys that thinks that, you know, I just got to talk about how things are better. Because if you're new, or if you've been around a while, you've been in and out, and I've been that guy. You know, the basis of our fellowship is based on identification, you know, and I don't want to, there's nothing special about me, but if I'm trying to participate the way that I've been asked, I don't want to go over somebody's head and talk about how recovered I am without getting the identification. I grew up in a normal middle-class family. I got a sister 3 years younger than me. My parents were married 49 years when my dad died, 8 or 9 years ago. And there was no alcoholism example in my house. My parents drank. They had a liquor cabinet and, you know, maybe wine in the refrigerator, beer, or something like that. But nobody went to excess, so I didn't grow up with an example of how to be an alcoholic. I didn't grow up with being unparented. I had every opportunity a kid could have to do things the right way. And I messed that up pretty good, as I'll get to. The first time I remember feeling the effects of alcohol was, best as I can tell, was junior high school. And they had junior high instead of middle school back then. And I had gotten, I hung out with these two brothers. It was a single mom, and she worked a lot. And then she had tried to have a social life. So they were alone a lot, which is where I went. It was just an automatic gravitation up Robindale Road to their house. And we got into whiskey. And I think it was iced tea. I mean, I don't remember, but I believe that's what it was. And the big, not the solo cups, but the hard plastic cups, we mixed some up in those. And they had one of those cheesy, cheap, all-in-one stereos with the 8-track and the cassette and the turntable and the whole 9 yards. So we would sit and listen to albums. There was no internet. And drink this stuff. And I remember feeling like I'm getting away with something. I remember feeling like this is pretty neat. You know, I mean, I had swiped candy from the store and pulled one over on my parents and stuff like that, but this was stepping up a level. I didn't get blind drunk or black out or puke or any of that other stuff, but you know, I remember feeling the effects of what we were drinking. I drank my entire drink, and you know, one of the brothers just didn't. We didn't know what we were doing. I mean, I probably tasted like garbage, but he's pouring his out in the sink. John was. Perry was the other brother. And we're getting on him for pouring it out because we could have had that, you know. And I've never, you know, I've had sips of beer and stuff like that from Dad, and I collected beer cans when I was like 12 and went to trade shows for that, so I was trying stuff. But it wasn't, you know, I never had a whole beer. And we were getting on him about that. So that's the very first time I remember feeling the effects produced by alcohol. They weren't major, but it was fun. And was getting away with it. When I went into high school, I don't remember a lot of my freshman year of high school. I'm not going year by year. This is just a couple of stages. But once I got into 10th grade in high school, I started running track and cross country, and I immediately had a large group of friends with something to do all the time. It wasn't like find out what's going on. There was always something going on. Somebody's parents were out of town. Somebody's parents were liberal. You know, we went to the VFW. We did that. We did that. And the drinking age was 18 back then. So alcohol was pretty easy to get. I mean, I think of that as just crazy today, being 18 years old and being able to go buy kegs or cases of beer in high school, you know, so it wasn't, it was very easy to get, very easy to get. So, you know, the sort of weekend parties after the meets and stuff like that would start, and it was, you know, we'd have a keg party at Judson's, or Richie's parents were out of town, or you know, my parents went out of town, they regretted it a couple of times, and stuff like that, you know, and there wasn't a lot of, serious consequences on the surface or, you know, individually. Occasionally, somebody would get too drunk and throw up or this or that, but it was kind of just a good time, to be honest with you. There was no kind of big red flag at that point. When I, you know, I really liked running a lot. I didn't care for school much. I was probably the low end of average student because I put no effort into it as far as my grades went. And I had to go to summer school, I remember, my junior year to be able to run my senior year. And so I did all that stuff. And then, you know, when the book talks about this stuff gets a hold of us long before we suspect it, you know, I've always pointed to when I went to college, those things exploded, and they did. I mean, they totally did. But I look back now at what happened my senior year in high school, and there's no question alcoholism was going on. You know, my track coach died. He got hit by a car on the road I lived on the summer between my junior and senior year. And I think that kind of gave me a bad attitude. So we had a new coach come in and that kind of thing. And I just, you know, I was rebellious. I was just like, you know, screw you and all this other stuff. And I was, you know, trying to smuggle beer to, we'd run up at Piedmont Community College, where they used to have the state meet and an invitational. And, you know, I'd take beer on the trip and try to hide it, and everything. I was poisoning the other athletes, basically, is what it, in attitude and other ways. And I got kicked off the team, you know. And you know, I never really looked at that as a consequence of my drinking. Now, it was kind of a combination of my drinking and my behavior, not necessarily drunk, and so forth. So things were happening before I really realized it. Got to the end of high school. My dad was like, "Well, you got to go to college." You know, I'm not a planner guy. You know, I'm just not. And so, like, sort of at the last minute, I'm like putting these applications together and stuff, and I got turned down from one school, which was his alma mater. He played football there, and he taught there, so it's pretty bad that I didn't get in, because all that was on the application. And but I did get in kind of next door, and you know, so I went off to school that fall, and you know, I was 18 years old. And it was the first time, I mean, we had taken road trips and we had beach week and all of a sudden, but it's the first time I was not under the microscope of anybody that really gave a crap what I did, as long as I didn't make it too loud and too out in the open. And there were a lot of other people doing the same thing. I mean, there is no question my drinking took off like a rocket. I was still running, and that kind of kept me in check a little bit for a while. We got to pick our own class schedule because of athletics. I didn't have to wait in line. I didn't have to worry about, was I going to get into this class or any of that. Just fill it out and turn it in. You know, and of course I adapted to the times and try to have a day off and that kind of thing. And then I had practices and stuff. So I wanted to participate in the running. I didn't care so much about the classes and stuff. So my drinking was mainly confined to Saturday nights at first, you know, and then there'd be like the in-between seasons, cross-country ends, indoor track start, that kind of thing. And as, you know, each couple of months went along, the drinking started increasing. You know, it was like, okay, this band's coming, or they've got penny beers, or they've got whatever's going on, and it would just, it was like a snowball going downhill, you know. And I started experiencing consequences in college, a lot of blackouts. I started blacking out a lot. Over half the time I drank in college, I would black out. And it didn't dawn on me that wasn't normal. You know, a lot of the people that I was hanging around, I don't know if they were blacking out because we didn't have a discussion round table about, did you black out last night? Yes, I did. You know, but other people were getting in trouble and puke. You know, it's like whoever falls furthest down the ladder, everybody else is pointing at them. And it wasn't always me, but at times it was. And, you know, as I went a little further in school, the drinking increased, and what meant most to me, which wasn't academics, but it was running, started to go by the wayside. I started drinking, like, you know, doing the same thing I did in high school, taking beer, trying to, you know, skirt the rules, trying to do this, trying to do that, you know, and getting into some other substances and that kind of thing. And, you know, before you know it, I still had the same coach. It wasn't, all the circumstances weren't the same, but I started the same behavior on that team as I had in high school. You know, and I was kind of, it was a mission to get Donnie from Pulaski to smoke weed and get drunk. It was a mission to, you know, get these other guys to do this and to do that so that I didn't feel, I guess, abnormal or like I was doing something that I shouldn't have been. One of the consequences that I got into later in the first year of college, another blackout. We had a fire drill, and it was a 13-story dorm with five-story wings. And I woke up the next morning with judicial, whatever they are, campus police charge papers in my pocket. I don't remember a thing. And it's like a couple of written paragraphs about how I acted and what I said and all this. I've still got it. It's actually kind of funny. But I didn't have any recollection of that whatsoever, nothing. I mean, the entire time. I didn't remember the fire alarm going off. I didn't remember going out. And it was the middle of winter. And any of that stuff, or maybe not the middle of winter, but it was very cold. And, you know, that was just to be laughed off, you know, just to be laughed off. Another consequence that I experienced in college was a friend of mine and I, when we would have a break and come home to, he was from Richmond too, and we would go out drinking, like his sister worked at the pizza place, we had our favorite bars or whatever it was, and both of us at the time were dating girls from Waynesboro, and so we did a lot of driving on the break back and forth to Waynesboro. And, and never had a problem. And I frequently didn't remember leaving or coming back, or some combination of that. 3 days past whatever day it was, I don't remember the dates now, but I woke up in my bed at home, and I was all busted up and stuff, and what we had done is flipped a Chevette on 64 over the guardrail into a tree. You know, and it's... when we went back, this is the sort of the ridiculous alcoholic mind part. When we went back to school, his parents took us, and we were on break. And we stopped, I want to say it was in Goochland, at some rec yard, and to look at the car. You know, I guess they wanted to show us and teach us a lesson or something. And I went into the windshield right above the dashboard, not wearing a seatbelt, and... the car was demolished. I mean, it was demolished. And it somehow, and I don't even know if anybody said this to me, but after we did that and got back to school, what my story became up here and then to you was, if I hadn't been drunk, I would have been dead. I would have stiffened up. I would have done this. And I would say the nurse told me. I don't remember if anybody told me. They could have. But that was my story, you know. It's just another "let me drink some more" kind of thing, and I didn't bat an eye at that, you know. I did not bat an eye. I mean, my sister and her friends—I'm kind of taking a half step back—but you know, they're when I woke up after those 3 days, my sister and friends were visiting me and all this, you know. "Are you okay?" You know, concerned, and I'm just like, "Let me out of here," you know, as if it was just nothing. So I wasn't willing to pay attention to any consequences that were going on. What I started doing then, I mean, my drinking got in the way of running. It got in the way of academics. I started being asked not to come back. Then I'd sit out a while, make another try at it. Then I'd retreat home. My parents' house was like a rest area. You know, I'd get a job for a little while. I was the king of temporary jobs and that kind of thing. You know, I'd go get an apartment. I'd make it a month or two being able to pay the bills, and then they'd be wanting the money at the first of the month, and I'd be like, "I'll have a tea in 3 or 4 days." And meanwhile, I'm drunk every day and every night. I got the kind of jobs that you could drink at, at least if not all the time, at least part of the time, and never batted an eye that there was anything wrong with my behavior. You know, it was like, it was almost as if I was waiting to find out, waiting to accept the maturity lottery that I was just going to grow up and grow out of this stuff. You know, I should say I did grow up going to church. Didn't participate, didn't listen, right over my head. Never connected, never tried to connect, went because I had to. I did not come into AA meetings with a hatred of God, but I did not come in with one scintilla of a relationship either. It was like a non-issue. And I started coming up with these, I had to come up with something because it was like I always needed help from my parents. And they were not like doling out money like the bank or anything like that, but it was like when things got really bad, they would help me out at least in part. So I knew the routine. I've got to come up with the spiel and the pep rally speech and all this other stuff about how I'm going to do different and listen to my dad's two-hour lecture about his friend who quit drinking and turned his life around. Never said anything about AA. But I knew I was going to have to endure that. And, just for a couple of years, it was just like that. In one apartment, out. Back to my parents' house. Another apartment, out. You know, I got arrested. I got pulled over a whole bunch. But I got arrested on June 11th, 89 for a DUI. And I'd been drinking all day at an apartment party, and I wasn't done. And this was at night. And... the officer had me get out. I was driving a 1970 Ford, I think F100 or something, three on the tree, no interior lights, no radio, no power steering. It looked like the Sanford Mobile. My dad had it for like hauling leaves and stuff like that, but it was okay to be on the road. And again, so the guy pulled me over in that and got me out of the truck, and you know, how much have I had to drink? Two or three beers, which is probably what I had in the truck with me. And he had me do the tests, and I failed, and I told him that that the parking lot that he was having me do this in was slanted, and it was. It's actually real close to where Jaywalkers is in Richmond. But the, you know, so he got his flashlight or something out in the middle of the street, and I failed those tests, where it was flatter, and I failed that too. And he took me down to lock up, and 3 hours later, you know, I blew the, they had a more liberal limit then, and I was twice that at that point, but I was aware of everything. I mean, I remember it like it was yesterday. And I'm sitting in there, and I'm looking, you know, remember, I haven't looked at any part of my life with my drinking, my behavior, the way that I treat people that has anything to do with my drinking. I'm looking at other people in there. You know, they got one handcuffed to the little rail seating that goes around. I'm like, these guys are toast. They're not. There's no way I'm gonna blow over this. And then I did, of course. And I walked home the next morning, which was a long walk from Chesterfield County Jail to Bon Air, and didn't bat an eye. And I, you know, I'm the kind of guy, if I get a court date, it's optional. Optional. And so I had the court date coming up for that in a couple of months, and I just did whatever I did, drinking and running around. And I got real close to it, and I'm like, what am I going to do? So I left town. What else are you going to do? And so I went hitchhiking down to South Carolina and back up through North Carolina and stayed gone for a little while. Never told my parents where I was. Occasionally I'd call them, but it was like meet the friend of a friend who has a trailer in Dunn, and I'm living with him for a little while, and then I try to get to Charleston and back up to, you know. Finally, I came back, and Dad, I need help, you know. And he got a lawyer, and I went to court, and that's how I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I went for ASAP, and there was some young girl that was the ASAP intake person that was very attractive at that time to me. I don't even remember what she looks like. But I remember them. I'm going to, you know, seduce her with my grandest drinking stories, you know. I mean, this is how my head's working. And so I'm spilling everything out, you know, and she's writing stuff down, and you know, not only do I have to do ASAP, but I've got to go to super counseling and, you know, some other testings and stuff like that. I'm just like, oh, my God. And she goes, but you got to go to AA meetings. And so I was 24 years old, and I got dropped off by my mom, at my first AA meeting, you know. It was up on Huguenot Road at the Baptist, I can't think of which Baptist church it is, but it's, anyway, she, you know, I recognized the entrance where the meeting was in a heartbeat, never having been there, the people sitting around smoking and getting, just like y'all were, you know, I'm like, just let me out here, you know, don't pull all the way up, you know, and that kind of thing, and I went in and I sat through the meeting, and I remember these two ladies named Joanne, everybody was nice, and that's all I can tell you, you know, and so for the next 3.5 years, I'd come in and out of AA meetings doing the same thing I already told you about. Apartment here, parents there, you know, this and that, ruining my credit, stealing, forging my dad's name because we got the same name so I can buy a whole bunch of weed on a cash advance when you got to walk into the bank and do it all, sell it, intercept the statement and then pay and, you know, very complicated stuff. And, you know, I did that stuff for the next 3.5 years, you know. And during that time of coming in and out of AA, I would go to meetings until I drank. I mean, we all can be different how we, you know, what our experience is. Mine was, I'm going to meetings, and then I'm drinking, and then I ain't coming back. You know, I never had the guts to come in here drinking. You know, I just couldn't pull that off. And you know, I was pretty miserable. You know, and ironically, my my thoughts, I guess, were that, you know, if I had a driver's license and I had a place to live, that was good, and I had a little bit of money and I had time to run and I had some dates, I wouldn't be living this way. Because I was looking at these guys I grew up with, some of which were doing the same thing that I was, and they've got houses and marriages and good jobs and all this other stuff, and I'm like, it's as if consciously and kind of subconsciously, I'm just waiting around for my time to arrive, you know. And what happened was, right before I came back in here for the last time, I hope, I had all that stuff. I had a nice apartment right off of the pool, living with a guy that I went to school with, high school. I had a very good paying job, you know. I had the car. I had the insurance. Everything was legal. You know, I could. I had the freedom to do what I wanted to do. You know, I didn't have any kids. I wasn't married. I could just do whatever I want. And what I was doing was hiding in my room, two-bedroom apartment, from my roommate, who was in a wheelchair, was paraplegic. And I positioned my furniture so that he could look into my room, but he couldn't come into my room. So I had an angle where I could sit by the window and drink as much beer as I wanted to, because I couldn't drink liquor anymore. I would immediately get sick, and listen to my clock radio and smoke cigarettes. And that's what I would do. And I had these things that I had said, if I had them all collectively together, I wouldn't be drinking and living this way. And, you know, a lot of times I had been felt in despair and wanted to blow my brains out, and I held the gun and rubbed it on me, you know, this high drama stuff. I mean, it's like, you know, the unpublished Bob Dylan album, you know, it that much. And, you know, but I went to an AA meeting April 17th, 1993, and I sat in that meeting. It was on a Saturday night. I sat in that meeting knowing that I was going to go drink as soon as the meeting was over. I'd done that enough to know exactly what that feels like. I didn't reach out to anybody. I didn't tell anybody. I didn't nothing. And I waited till the meeting was over. I didn't get up and leave. Meeting was over. Drove to the intersection of Hall and Courthouse to the Amoco. Loaded up. Stayed drunk for 3 days. Woke up. 3 days later, with my roommate throwing a piece of his wheelchair at me, saying, if you don't do something about your drinking, you're going to die. And this is what I thought. I'm sitting on the sofa, kind of half crying. It was legitimate, but I'm not full-blown wailing. I'm just like, and I've watched this guy go through hell, because he broke his neck in high school in a diving accident. He was a high jumper. And, you know, I saw him in Hopkins, MCV, you name it. So I was listening to him. He hit me at the right time. And, you know, I'm like, well, I've been to AA. Not saying this out loud. I've been to AA and it doesn't work. I mean, look at me. And so I called up, out of the phone book, like St. Mary's, and I went and saw this lady. And she said, you got to go to AA meetings. I'm like, great. You know, and really for the first time in my life, I was as honest with her as I could be about the real reality of my drinking, of the other stuff that I was doing. I just kind of vomited it all out on her. And she goes, you got to go back to AA. You know, so I went back. I was a sucker for punishment. I went back to the same church I had left, because they had the meetings there two nights a week. Same church, went back. Went to the meeting. I dreaded picking up the white chip. I hated picking up white chips. I hated it. I felt humiliated. It's not humiliating if you get to pick one up. I'm just telling you, at that time, that's how I saw it. And I got out there, and I felt like I was standing there for like 3 or 4 minutes because they were out of white chips, and Randy, the guy giving them out, was like fishing through his pockets and got a quarter. So a quarter was my last white chip, you know. And, you know, so I started going back to meetings, and as normal, you know, I'm looking for somebody to latch on to or some people to have fun with. I'm not here strictly for sobriety, thank you. And I get involved with a group of people that it was just, it was nuts. You know, nobody was really sponsored, but they were sticking together. You know, I mean, it was like they might have a sponsor, do that. So it was a bunch of young people, and it was, and I felt like I was in no man's land. I was 28 years old, and they had, you know, you had the 16-year-olds coming in, 17-year-olds out of treatment, and everybody else was, you know, 45 or 50. That was just, you know, and I'm 52 now, and it's, yeah, that kind of thing. And so I just kept, you know, I just kept going to meetings and hanging around these people, and they were enthusiastic about being together, and they were enthusiastic about going to meetings. And back then, let me just put it this way, the meetings were good. There wasn't a focus on the Big Book. There wasn't a focus on doing the steps. There was more of a fellowship focus. And, you know, you could do the steps in this. It might be the Hazleton Guide, or it might be something else, or it might be this, or it might be that. And I'm not putting that down. It was just the way that it was back then, you know. And so I'm chugging along, and I got a couple of months of not drinking. And I came up this, I don't remember what the day was, but this one day I decided I wasn't going to be an AA anymore. You know, I'm like, I'm done with this crap. I'm done. I couldn't have called it restless, irritable, and discontented then, but that's what it was. You know, I was about to explode. And so I knew what my drinking was like. If I started drinking, I knew what it was going to be like. I need something to help keep me up. And I did a lot of other stuff, but nothing replaced the alcohol. So I called this guy to get this substance, and he always got it. Every single time. Every time. Because I'd sit at his house and do half of it before I left after I paid him for it. Between us. You know, and I called him up. He goes, let me call you back. That wasn't abnormal. So I waited a few minutes and he called me back. No cell phones. And he called back. He's like, I can't get it. What am I going to do? You know, I had it all planned out. The eight ball, the case of Molson, the room at the Omni, give the concierge my keys, I can't get another DUI, you know, that kind of, I'm going to live it up like I haven't been able to live it up before. And I'm just, you know, I can feel, what am I going to do? A handful of minutes later, two of those young people showed up at my parents' house where I was staying at this time, and they're like, hey, come on, we're going to wherever they were going. I don't even remember where it was, you know. And they didn't, I didn't say anything to them about that experience. Matter of fact, I don't think I told anybody about it. Maybe my sponsor. I honestly don't remember. It wasn't like I said, oh, my God, guess what happened. You know, I just went with them. And I look back on that experience, and there is absolutely no question in my mind that God stepped between me and taking those actions, no doubt. You know, I didn't have that relationship. I had started to do a few little things like pray at night and pray in the morning and stuff like that. But there's absolutely no question that God stepped in between there. You know, and our literature talks about that. You would normally expect it a little later maybe, but it was, looking back on it, it was a very powerful experience. So fast forward, I'm going to drink again, sitting in this meeting. This girl that I'm chasing is telling me, well, I followed her to a Big Book meeting. I did not want to go to the Big Book meeting. I wasn't interested in the Big Book meeting. I don't care about that. But she's going, I'm going. That's it. So I've been going a little while, and she's like, why don't you go talk to this guy? Go talk to him. I saw you listening to him. And I'm like, how? You know, kind of thing. But that one time, I knew when I left there I was going to drink. And it was 50.1 to 49.9. You know, I walked across the room and I told him, I said, I'm going to go train. And I don't want to. I don't know if I've ever done a first step. I don't know if I've ever done a second step. I never even got that far. And he sat down and talked to me and began to sponsor me. You know, and he came up with the most ridiculous list of crap that he wanted me to do, like call him on time, like show up at his house on time, like go to this amount of meetings on time. I had a problem with time. You know, I mean, I felt like, you know, like I had landed in boot camp. I mean, it was just like, oh my, it's exactly what I needed. You know, I mean, the initial resist was there tenfold. I was saying stuff under my breath as I was walking away or getting off the phone with him that I didn't dare say to his face. You know, but most of the stuff I went ahead and did. And a couple of things that were pretty important, I mean, is like go through the steps. But two things, one was when I wrote my inventory. And I don't know about you, I've been busted for embezzlement. I've definitely stolen. I've burned stuff to the ground. I haven't been the worst of the worst, but there's definitely lines I've crossed. No question about it. I had no problem. I mean, there was a little bit of shame, humiliation, regret, whatever you want to call it, telling him some of the things like the embezzlement, because it was from a one-man show in his own business and stuff like that. But what I really didn't want to tell him was the sex stuff. You know, it was like, you know. So I went to his house, and I'd say it was two or three things. It was at least two and probably three. I just don't remember. A couple of things I did not write down on my inventory, on my four step. And I went and sat in his kitchen, and I had absolutely zero intention of telling him those. You know, I'm just going to do this. There's enough good stuff in here that he's going to believe me, and I'll be all right. And after I sat down, he said some stuff, and and those were some of the first things out of my mouth. You know, I don't remember if he asked me, tell me the stuff you didn't write down, or what's the big secret, or I don't know. I don't remember. You know, but those were some of the first things. It was all downhill from there. You know, and I left his house, drove home, hour and 15 minutes, I guess, something like that. And I was very much a literalist at that point. And it's, you know, take the book down from the shelf, and I'm, you know, take an hour right after this, and I'm like, well, I got an hour drive home. So I got the book open in the passenger seat, and I'm reflecting on the first five, you know. Not the smartest thing in the world, but I ended up okay. But the good part of that, and I'm not trying to justify I shouldn't have been doing that. I'm just saying the good part of that on the whole was that I started to become hungry for Alcoholics Anonymous because my life was changing, and I didn't even realize it. You know, I still had fear, I still had trepidation, I still had worry and all this other stuff, but because of my participation in AA, because of following my sponsor's directions, my life was changing, you know, and I could feel that really before I could see it, you know, because God's joke was, here's the crap you asked for and you said you wouldn't drink, look at you. You know, I'm not saying he does it that way, I'm just kind of making a joke, you know, but, you know, I started feeling more comfortable in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I didn't feel like completely comfortable. I didn't feel like I belonged all the way. But I wasn't as nervous, as sweaty, as jittery after I did that in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the other thing from that inventory that I want to tell you about is when I got to amends, you know, thank God for sponsorship. You know, my list was all of the girls that I had dated, you know, let's just say it's 1 through 6, seriously, not you know, the one night thing or whatever, but you know, I need to make amends to that. And I'll be honest with you, in the back of my mind, it was like, you know, maybe we can straighten this out and something will work out. Yeah. And so I go to my sponsor with this stuff. He's just, you know, laughing at me. And he's telling me, you know, but there was one thing on there. You know, the one thing he told me about the family is you didn't harm them the most collectively. You got to make appointments with each one and go make those amends. And I did that. It was awesome. But the one thing on there that really, that I felt the worst, it wasn't the worst thing I'd ever done, but that I felt the worst about, you know, I'm like, what about this one? And it was a girl that I dated for a good period of time. He's like, no way. You know she's married. You know she has kids. You're going to walk into her life, turn it upside down so that you feel better? He goes, you stay willing. If you're willing, the opportunity may present itself. And Serenity Weekend 2000, I'd gone and come home. It was a Saturday night. Phone rang. I answered the phone. There was this voice on the phone. It was a girl. Just talking so fast, I couldn't follow it. And, you know, she said, do you know who this is? And I was like, keep talking. I'll get it. And, I mean, it was familiar, but I couldn't place it. She's like, Jennifer. Which one? I mean, I had a couple of friends, Jennifer. I had a Jennifer I dated. I had no idea what was going on. Oh, okay. This is the one. You know, and this was 4 or 5 weeks before I got married. And I'm like, yeah, sponsor. It's like 11 o'clock at night. You know, I can't call him. I'm on the phone with her. He can answer the phone anyway. Very first time I can tell you I remember clearly asking God for help. You know, not the get me out of the ditch help, but what do you want me to do here? I don't know what to do. The only thing that came to me was you may not get another chance. It's the only thing that came to me. And so I tried to talk her into, bring your husband, we'll meet for a cup of coffee. I just said, what do you want to talk? Yeah. So I ended up telling her on the phone, which would not have been my first choice. I didn't harm her over the phone. And her answer to me was, we were kids. Yeah, we were kids. I said, is there anything that I... And I went into some detail without being dramatic about it so that she knew I knew what I was talking about. I said, is there anything else that I need to clean up with you? And she went on like I flicked her off riding down the Lothian Turnpike one day and, you know, a couple little, okay, I'm really sorry about that, don't remember a thing, that kind of thing. But it was just, it was amazing to me that I got the opportunity to clear that up right before I got married. You know, I mean, that's another example of God in my life. And there's plenty of them. They're not all confined to these dramatic incidents. But that was earlier in sobriety, and they were powerful. I've kind of done the same stuff since I've been sober, the way that I've been taught in AA. Hopefully I've grown a lot since then. But it's been going to a lot of meetings. It's been reaching out to other men and women sometimes in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a problem with 2 or 3 years. I couldn't get a sponsee to stick to save my life. You know, I mean, the first one, I could hear him inside the apartment when I pulled in from working to go listen to his fifth step. I could hear the scurrying noises in the apartment. Come on, man, open up. We're going to do your fifth step. He never came to the door. I was pissed. You know, there's my opportunity down the drain, you know. I mean, it wasn't any opportunity down the drain. It was just me being pretty self-centered. But as time went on, you know, I began to get guys, and I gave them what was given to me. You know, and I've got some that I've sponsored for a long time, and I've got a couple that are crazy new, you know. And I wouldn't change that for anything. I went, that girl, I told you it was a couple of weeks, the men's thing, before we got married. We were married for 14 years, had a son in 2010, which is awesome. My vote was against the son, against any kids. Don't want them, not interested, no thank you. You know, and before he was born, just things changed. You know, this was not one of those, like, the telephone, the guy can't get the stuff, or the people showing up at the house. It was just things changed. I'm all the way in. You know, I went to every OB appointment. I went to every hospital visit. I went to every test. I went to every everything. And when he was born, you know, it was a not a natural delivery. I'm on the other side of the sheet, and he's born, and he ain't breathing. And everything's okay now, and I feel for parents. I really do. But at that point in time, you know, they're on the phone calling the respiratory specialist team, whatever, and I already know things are going to be okay. You know, I'm not flipping out or losing it. In another minute, he starts breathing, and everything's cool. You know, and I don't, I would have been half lit sitting in there if I was there at all, if it wasn't for AA. You know, it's been the, other than sobriety, that's been the greatest gift in my life. Let me tell you about something that was really tough in sobriety. I'm sitting at home one night, I don't know what time, it was a Monday night, probably like 11 o'clock, eating my salad. I eat a lot of salad. And my wife at the time comes home and tells me she wants a divorce. She'd gone to a meeting, and we'd had problems back and forth and this and that and something else and arguing and whatever, but it wasn't anything. It was no grand slam home run of problems. I'm like, okay, how are we going to handle this? You know, like, I'm already on the next step. And what that did to me, it was in sobriety. You know, the thing with my son, my literally having to allow my dad to die right in front of me. Job stuff. This hands down was the most difficult thing I've ever been through in sobriety. I became very angry. I became very indignant. I became super quiet, which means I'm plotting and scheming and strategizing and, you know, all that other stuff. And I mean, I was angry. I can't tell you the level of fear and the level of resentment, the level of anger that I felt. I mean, it was totally justified. When it talks about us not being able to handle justifiable anger, I was the exception. This is, I can prove this in a court of law. It's 100% justifiable. And so I kind of went about my ways looking at it that way, you know. And it didn't last long where I had to finally go to my sponsor because I realized that wasn't getting me anywhere. And I don't say that lightly. But I went to him, I go, what do I do? What do I have to do? And, you know, he said, you know, you're going to do an inventory, you're going to go to more meetings, you're going to make a point out of reaching out to people you normally wouldn't reach out to, like in certain situations. Do not leave a meeting without offering some type of help to somebody, period. You know, and I have never had a surrender like that since the first time I walked in. I would hear speakers talk about that, like surrenders and sobriety. And I've been through, you know, my dad, that wasn't easy. Nothing like this, you know. And, I mean, I changed almost everything. For about 2.5 or 3 days, I barely prayed. I did the morning and I did the night. But I had become so regimented and predictive in how I was going to pray and how I was going to do things that I just wiped it all out. Said, what's going to come back will stay, and some new stuff. And that's exactly how that happened. You know, my sponsor also gave me some specific instructions about my strategy. I was to surrender, period. Either surrender or you don't. And I surrendered. You know, today, I see things a lot differently. We have, as my son's mom and I have a good relationship. You know, my son is the primary focus of that relationship. We also have discussions about what's going on in my life or what's going on in her life. I mean, we're not hanging out all the time, but everything is cool. There's not an ounce of resentment there. I'm not that guy, folks. I'm not going to let you off the hook. I'm not going to forget. I'm not going to forgive. you know, that's what AA did for me. I mean, it was just a very, very powerful experience. You know, I've gotten, you know, a lot of other, some people call them God shots, but awarenesses and that kind of thing. I was talking to Billy a little bit before the meeting about, you know, how I don't hear things the way that I used to hear them. I'm not nearly the judgmental person that I was. I'm perfectly capable of judging any situation in the blink of an eye. The difference now for me is that my conscience and my God conscience is more likely to step in quicker. You know, before I just kind of massaged it and proved it and pushed it. And most of the time, I don't do that anymore, you know. And if you had sort of painted my life as it exists today when I walked in here, I probably wouldn't have taken it. I don't want that crap. I don't want a life like that, you know. But I wouldn't trade my life today for anything, given everything that I've been through. You know, I've got, I've probably, untold number of people that I can call in an instant and speak with whatever I need to talk about. I've got untold number of people I could show up at their house. Remember doing that when we were drinking? I did that a lot, just showing up at their house, you know, I mean, and be welcome no matter what time it is or what's going on. You know, it's an amazing thing that I couldn't have seen if I didn't participate in this. And what has been drilled into me since the beginning continues to be the thing that's drilled into me today. I need to be actively more concerned about helping you than getting my own help. I understand there's things I need to do. I understand there are, you know, I've got to go to meetings. I've got to call my sponsor. I've got to reach out. I've got to do this. I've got to do that. I've got to pray. I've got, sure, there's just like I've got to eat and breathe, you know. But taking the focus off of me is not an easy thing for me to do. So I need simple little instructions from my sponsor and from other people and hearing people share their stories about making sure that I become actively interested in other people's lives. And when I do it that way, which I don't do all the time, you know, I can get pity and this and that and frustrated and resentful and so forth. But when I do that, regardless of how the arrangement in my life is suiting or not suiting me, it always gets better. It always gets better. Like, I would have told you it never will. Or it won't. It's just going to stay this way. It always gets better, you know. And I guess most of all, behind, underneath, involved in all that is a relationship with God that I would have never told you would have been possible. You know, I kind of did the anti-God thing that I didn't talk about when I was drinking, and I came in here ambivalent, and I'm telling you, that AA and God and you all have changed my life. And one day at a time, I don't have to live like that anymore. Thanks for having me.